Good morning. Good morning. I'd like to welcome everybody to the Finance and Administration Committee for January 13th. I want to welcome all of our new members that are at the table with us. Good morning, Ms. Wells, Ms. Hines. Right now, those are the only new members right now. But thank you for joining us. We'll welcome you. The agenda is before you. Are there any comments, changes to the agenda? Hearing no objections, we'll move to the approval of the minutes. Is there a motion?
So moved.
Is there a second on the motion
second.
For approval? Are there any questions, discussions? Hearing none, all those in favor?
Aye.
I have to ask for a vote, yet, guys. I oppose.
Abstention.
Abstention of one, two, and probably a third here, okay? I think that's an approval.
We've got to watch who's on the committee.
Well, I think we have enough of everybody. The minutes are approved. We have three information items for this morning. The first one is the overview of the program management services and the capital improvement for 2012 through 17. And Ms. Kitzel, you're going to begin us on that presentation. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. And I don't know the new board members, but welcome. My name is Carol Kitzel. I'm the Chief Financial Officer here. I'm going to introduce Dave Donatelli, who is our program management from Parsons Brinckerhoff, who we brought in this fall to actually augment our program management staff, since we actually had one of the largest capital budgets that we are embracing on since construction of Metro. He is going to provide for you the work that they have done this first quarter with us and give you a view of their progress on the program management systems, where we are, our annual work plan. So, Dave, if you can provide that.
Thank you. Thanks, Carol. The next slide, please. The last time that the board met the Finance Committee, one of the lead behinds as part of the handout was the activities that the PMS team was doing, the Project Management Services team. And in the graphic we have on the board, it indicates activities with deliverables. We started, as Carol indicated, in September, right towards the end of the first quarter for FY11. And what we were tasked to do was put quarterly reports together to assist WMATA, and we completed that by 45 days after the close of the first period, and that was November 15th. We also supported WMATA in preparation for the annual work program, the master schedule, and cost tracking completed by the end of December. I'm going to talk about these in more detail. And for project delivery risk tracking system, this is the process and the procedures that we are working on putting in place to be able to assist WMATA with delivery of the capital improvement program as planned and approved by the board. And I want to continue to be able to indicate transparency in what we are doing so that all of the program managers have the information whenever that is collected and shared with them. Next slide. One of the items that led to the overall program was looking at a yearly activities and milestones that we would accomplish over this period of time. And if we look at the third bar down where it talks about the quarterly report, I'll speak to that in more detail right after this slide, along with the annual work program. But the whole purpose, as I mentioned, is to provide transparency. And as we look at the bottom graphic, we can see that as we move further into the program and we develop the procedures, we're building confidence in delivery of the system and providing mitigations and measures to be able to move projects that need a push forward so that we meet the forecast requirements with expenditures. Next slide. This graphic indicates the quarter one progress report, the makeup of the report, indicating it's a new quarterly report that's required as part of the capital funding agreement. And as I mentioned earlier, one of the requirements was to have this in place 45 days, the report, 45 days after the close of the quarter, which we did do for November 15th. One of the items is we reviewed from collection of data the actual expenditures against the forecast, and we came up with a list of projects that had a variance greater than $2 million. And the whole purpose was to be able to come up with mitigations to be able to get those projects back on track again. And if you look at the graphic on the right-hand side where it talks about spending performance, you can see that this is the result of quarter one. The forecast indicated $158 million would be expended, but $77 million. So about 50%, 49% of the forecast was expended in quarter one. Now, we came in right towards the end. So whenever I talk about the projects that had a variance, there probably was about nine projects that made up 80% of the shortfall, that about $82 million between the 77 and the 158. So it was not a large amount of projects. And when we talked about all the projects in the CIP, there's about 140 projects. So whenever you look at the ones that needed to be able to have mitigation measures move forward to be able to push them along the way, it was probably about nine projects. Refined quarterly question. A cash flow was part of this activity. And the quarterly report right now focuses.
Mr. Donatelli, I'm sorry. Maybe we interrupt you a moment for a question for Mr. McKay.
Thank you. Among the nine projects, was there a generic common reason for the delay that you identified, or is it different for each of them?
The first thing we found was the fact that there was lack of a overall master schedule. And whenever we did a risk analysis early in the program, that was one of the items that we did find. In looking at it, it was almost as though there wasn't the transfer of data going back and forth. And I'll give you just the summation of those projects we looked at. Whenever the project was being completed, it was pushed on to the next phase. It may have been pushed into procurement. At that time, the program manager didn't continue to follow that into the procurement phase because that was another department's responsibility. So what we're finding is there needs to be more information coming back to the program manager tied to a schedule, tied to a process about how they move these projects forward, and being able to provide this information up to the senior managers within WMATA to be able to also have that information. That pretty much is what we found. And we could go into more detail.
I think that answers my question. The main thing I wanted to know is, was it a common problem that's easier to fix than if there was a different reason for each of these that it was occurring?
What I've given you was what we have seen as a common element. I won't call it a problem, just yet, a common element that we have to deal with. Each of the individual projects, though, that we looked at had different items. I'm going to get into some of those in the results of quarter two variance to where that just closed the end of December, and we have more information. You'll see, but since you're asking the question, you'll see that there's issues popping up with staff that may be required to provide support. It may be how funding is, or how expenditures are posted, such as operating costs that are part of the CIP project for approximately a year. That may not have been posted against the expenditure. Once that's posted, that gives a better picture, a truer picture of the expenditure that should have been recorded, it wasn't. So these are the issues that we get with the program managers, and we sort through these as part of the mitigation measure. The last point I want to make is the quarterly report right now addresses the CIP programs, but going forward in the future, we will also address all projects, the reimbursables, the ERA projects, safety and security, and grant projects. And just for your information, just in the ERA projects, that's another 130 projects that need to be tracked. Next slide. For transparency, all I wanted to do is be able to show evolution of the CIP budget. And the first line, the gray line up on the graph, indicates from fiscal year 11 to 16 that the board approved for about $5 billion. And this was modified between June and October to take into consideration the bulleted items up above, the NTSB recommendations, additional rehabilitation requirements incorporated. Now, if you look down at the green bars, you can see on the right-hand side, NTSB recommendation of about $254 million. To be able to accommodate that and hold the budget at $5 billion, there were deferrals that had to take place. About five projects up in the listing with the red text to where they were budgeted dollars taken out to be able to accommodate NTSB. Also, we wanted to be able to have projects incorporated for state of good repair. So that also was put in to the budget numbers that we have indicated, but it still is being maintained at the $5 billion after that. The two lower green bars to the right is putting the deferrals that were taken out through FY 11 and 16 in as part of FY 17. So they're back in, and that tallies up to about $346 million, and also balance of new FY 17 projects that came from the capital inventory listing that made up the bulk of FY 17. Whenever that budget was put in, it moved the number from $5 billion to about $5.9. Now, the next slide indicates...
Move there. And on the criteria of those that were deferred, was there a particular...
Yes, the criteria that was used made sure that it was not a project associated with state of good repair. They were more or less enhancements that were being made to where we could defer that by projecting out into the outer years the completion of those projects. And that wasn't our decision. That was with WMATA. It was a team effort.
Yes.
Next slide from June, from October to December, the 5.9 stays at the top, which is FY 11 through 16 plus, the addition of FY 17. And this is nothing more than showing refinements that occurred during October to December, and it adjusted NTSB and added additional state of good repair projects. And whenever I say adjusted NTSB, it didn't reduce the projects that were put in. There were conceptual estimates that were made initially whenever NTSB projects were first identified. With more detail, they were refined. Whenever they were refined, we found that the cost could be reduced to still provide the same amount of work associated with those projects. So they more or less tallied up the plus and minuses, with additional projects indicating in the green to the right the state of good repair. So during this period of time, there were some adds and deducts, but still maintained a budget of 5.9. So it's 5.89 to 5.9. Next slide. Next slide more or less just gives an update on the budget, the actual funding, rather. The funding started out at the 5.1 whenever it was approved by the board, and there was a debt shift into FY 17 of $76 million. Then the balance of the revenue forecast that made up the new projects shows the actual tracking of $5 billion to the 5.9 to be able to have the budget for a seven-year period from FY 11 to FY 17. And then there was the issue addressed of reduction in federal funding to where it went from the 4% for years 12 and 13 down to zero, flat. That had to be taken into consideration, and that's reflected in the minus 173, along with the jurisdiction portions reduced as well. So now you see where the reductions were, and then right below that, the additions that built up the budget to be able to have the funding required to accommodate FY 17 at the 5.9, with another year of debt that was put in by the jurisdictions by the capital funding agreement, consistent with past years. So it's about $86 million, then rollover of the Metro Matters performance funds and some residual funds.
Madam Chair, could I ask?
Go down, please.
I just want to be sure in terms of board process. The amendments that are affecting FY 11 were the ones we dealt with earlier, and that 17 as an add-on year will be formally dealt with when we do the budget in the spring?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah. So these are projections at this point. It does not reflect the board-approved final program.
Yes, the board-approved final program will be, as you know, in June, as the board approves the operating budget. So what we're describing for you is now our picture of the FY12, or Dave is, and actually detailed in the budget book, which we'll have on the next presentation. So, yes.
Okay, next slide. The project's just a representation of the key plan deliverables for state of good repair. There's a whole listing. Now, you can't read the ones that are shaded, but what we wanted to do is pop out a couple just for your information. You could see the replacement of 100 Metro buses and the rehabilitation of 100 more, an installation of 30 turnouts, 15,000 direct fixation fasteners, and the cross ties. So these are examples of what will be completed in FY12, fortifying the state of good repair from the CIP projects. Next slide. This slide was already presented, but I discussed with you the initial milestones, the early milestones. But in looking at the program, this is driven by process, procedures, and the sharing of that information with the program manager so they have that available. What I'd like to do now is talk more about the program management. And what we've done is that the master schedule, one of the items I mentioned was missing whenever we first started on the project. We have a draft of that now that's submitted to WMATA for review, and we completed that by the end of December. Now, that's just the first step. We have a lot more to do to populate that, but at least we have the makeup of that master schedule. We also have a work breakdown structure that's going to permit us to capture those. I'm going to talk about that in more detail, but this more or less just indicates that in looking at this graphic, you see the diamonds, the blue diamonds up there that go from a light to dark. The purpose of that is so that as we develop these processes and procedures, there's going to be more confidence in the system that whenever we get towards the end of the year, there's going to be the actual building confidence that's been completed. Next slide. The master schedule, just to go over briefly the makeup of this, it includes the work breakdown structure, and the work breakdown structure is permitting us to accommodate not just the CIP projects, but the ERA projects, the reimbursable projects, and the safety and security. And you can see that there's elements down below on the lower portion of the slide in the green that indicates the heading for the projects once they're populated into the schedule. There's going to be consistency in reporting across all projects, and that's going to be key. Interdependencies are key to this, and this more or less ties down to making decisions to move certain things forward. For instance, without a master schedule, if there was a delay on a test track, and that test track is dependent upon the delivery of the rail cars, there's no tie to show that. With the master schedule, we're going to have that tie, be discussing it with the program managers if there's any slip to that, so mitigations can be put in place to be able to keep the project moving. Next slide. Top delivery proactive risk management. Top projects with expenditures and underruns. Now, this has the caveat of proactive. And what I mean by that is that we're not waiting until the end of a quarter to do a variance report for CIP projects. This is the results of the second quarter, first month, October, that we looked at, because we are collecting expenditures on a monthly basis. But whenever we put the report together, that's on a quarterly basis. We're not waiting before we do mitigations one-on-one with the program managers to be able to see where differences or trends may be focused. And here, whenever we did the variance report, again, we saw these projects that were missing the mark. So what we did is did one-on-one interviews with the program managers, identified what the issues are. And here's a good example of what issues we found on the top heading. So we saw staff was needed because of potential slippage in 107, 110, and 119, schedule refinements and deferrals, operating of the operations to capital cost transfer, and some refinements to NTSB. Whenever we go through this, and, you know, I'd like Carol just to speak to CIP 057, whenever we identified this in October, we went to Carol and says, this is a big ticket item, about $66 million. Right. It may miss the mark.
And let me explain further, because that's exactly right. And what it says here is a schedule refinement, but what really is happening, this is an expenditure discussion. So the large payment to make to our car manufacturer that's replacing the 1000 series was expected to be made in September, October. And as a result of some refinement of the schedule and the discussions between the manufacturer approving subcontractors with Dave's team, that payment wasn't made until December. So it's really a deferral of the expenditure, not a deferral of the project, which is still on track. But I can safely say now, and if you looked at the first half of the year, which is the December, we've actually went from an expenditure rate in the first quarter overall for the CIP of 9%. And if I look at my second half now, I'm now at a 30% expenditure rate. So it's really just that particular project is an expenditure issue. And we're taking advantage of that in the intelligence that Dave's group is providing to the project team and our team as we look at it, because it's now an expenditure basis. If we can't make the expenditures, we're going to be moving those funds into other areas and projects that we can, so we can manage, since we are not any longer on an obligation-based capital budget. We are now on an expenditure base. So we're utilizing our expenditures and our cash forecasts more efficiently. So.
Madam Chair, yeah, question on the work breakdown structure. We're seeing here the kind of top level, the total project. Is there a more detailed breakdown below that that you'll be tracking?
Yes, yeah. More. The breakdown that we have below this is a detail that takes the project, each individual project, and identifies the stages. And what I mean by that, it talks about the planning, the engineering, the construction, mm-hmm. and close out of the contract, all the way all to the close way to out of the contract. All of that is captured underneath of, you know, the work breakdown structure.
Yeah, I want to thank you for the effort this morning to make this understandable. This is a very sophisticated system you're outlining here, and but I want to stress a couple things. One, it's critically important, and it was mentioned already in your briefing, that this is a team effort. It can't be just the finance side. It has to be the program manager side. And I think that to me is very critical. And the determination of the deficiencies of why we're not meeting these goals certainly to me would fall more on the program side. And so that has to be focused very clearly. I'm looking at page 13 here, and I'm saying, well, who's making these determinations of the needs, you know, and so that was what generated my question. But let's go down a little more basic. You know, we have somewhere like 12 station rehabs and 12 mini rehabs scheduled for fiscal 12. Have we completed all the fiscal 10 ones? And where are we projected to be on the fiscal 11 program? So can we hear about that? Because clearly we've heard before in previous briefings that we're not really keeping up and we're getting a little behind, and of course everything gets shifted then. So can someone kind of address that, Dave?
Okay. Well, good morning. My name is Dave Kubicek. It's Bell CF, two Daves up here. In regards to the station rehabs, where we're doing the mini rehabs and the full-blown ones, those have been targeting 100% right on schedule. And one of the things I'd also like to add is that we're going to be doing a presentation in the customer service operations committee here in a few hours. And what we're going to do is we're going to go through some schedule outages of what we're doing, what we're forecasting, you know, like for the next year. And that type of information and detail is feeding up into this overall process. And so it has to flow very smoothly. And with us working in a larger schedule and having this master list, we have a place to flow all of this information and work efforts up into. And the other thing that I'd also like to stress is it's not just one department. It's the entire agency of what we're pushing on our part. It's rolling stock. It's elevator escalators, it's buses, it's IT, because all of these areas intertwine with one person. And our consistent message to my staff is there's one form, one document, one focus, so that way we can get these expenditures moving forward.
Thank you. Mr. Downey already mentioned the one thing I was concerned about, the project level detail. When would you anticipate that would be available in this kind of reporting system?
The project level detail that we're shooting for right now is going to be the end of March, to where we're doing project level detail now. But for us to be able to take and push down to the level of detail that I discussed, or, you know, that I mentioned to Mark, mm-hmm. Mark, that's going to be sometime around the end of March, whenever we have the system in place. And what we're talking about whenever we have that system in place is a web base that's going to be available for all program managers to be able to call up the information specific on their CIP project and get the expenditures, their forecast, in the schedule so that they'll be able to view it, not only the program managers, but anybody else invited to that site to view those projects.
I'd also like just to comment a little bit on this, on the overall program schedules. One of the things that was a big challenge starting for was not only just getting the information collected, but it was also the timeliness of it, because as PB was working on collecting this information and they were trying to put it together, we work with the finance department, all these other layers, by the time that actually gets processed, you just ate up 60 days. And then, you know, you have the project in that time frame that was still moving forward. So that's a critical area on our part. Moving forward, working with PB and stuff, is how can we get this as close to real time as humanly possible, and also working with Carol's staff to make sure that that information is posting in within the system, so that way, whenever we do come to the board and stuff, we're not talking about 60 days, you know, behind. It's as close to a snapshot as possible, and that's very, very critical, you know, at least on my part, as we move forward based on the requirements on how we manage our capital and even our operating budget.
Yeah. John Kelly, for reasons you're aware of, I'm not terribly up on what your scope is, but does it include more than just neutral scorekeeping? Will you be making recommendations as to how program management can be more clearly effectuated and how
yes.
problems can be dealt with?
Right, that we're doing right now. Yeah. More, when, that we're doing right now whenever we talk about the fact that we discussed with the management the need for the master schedule, the need to do the variance report, come up with mitigations, be proactive. So whenever we talk about this, there's, you know, it's welcome with open arms. By
yeah,
the
I mean, one of the things I heard earlier, I certainly agree with the fact that the project manager should be responsible for every aspect
yes.
of his or her project.
Right.
Yeah. I just want to add to that, Mort. That was one of the original reasons for bringing up someone in like PB to help us actually create a capital program management program, is not only to help do the work, but to really provide oversight and identify those areas, not only for management to take action, but also for the board to understand it. So it's sort of a semi-independent role from just the day-to-day management.
I have one last slide, and that has to do with the staff augmentation. And staff augmentation is just a thumbnail of what WMATA is putting in place right now as a result of some of the mitigations. We talked before about having key staff out in the field for the red line and for the orange and the blue line. And you could see that these positions have been filled already by WMATA. So things are moving forward. We're continuing to provide support in these areas as well. That concludes my presentation.
Thank you very much, Mr. Donatelli. I appreciate the presentation, and it is very critical to what we're doing. As we go into the next item, we are talking about moving forward in the capital budget, but when we approved this budget, we said we wanted to see a higher expenditure. We wanted to see higher accountability as to how we were really responding to our customers as to why and how are we addressing all of these capital needs. And I guess the one that stands out to me is the slide 15, that you can see the integration. You can see where both the program financing and everyone have come together, and that accessibility of that is what contributes to the efficiency and the level of risk that we recognize when we're making decisions on the spot about how to affect our capital budget and meet that. Mr. Benjamin, and are there any other questions?
Okay, I'd sort of like to put this whole presentation in a context because I think it's very important. We have shifted from having an obligation-based budget to having an expenditure-based budget, which means that instead of considering the money to be gone when you enter into a contract, the money is gone when it actually goes in a check to the contractor or to pay the staff. It's a much more difficult way to manage your money, but a much more efficient way to manage your money and your projects. Traditionally, project managers have a much more difficult time putting together an expenditure budget and managing to expenditures than they do putting together an obligation budget and managing to obligations. So what we're seeing here is us going in a transition from one form into the other form. So what we're doing here is not saying, oh, well, we have a problem with how we're delivering our program. We are, in fact, saying this is the set of changes that need to be made in order to make this program delivery as efficient as possible and to use the money as effectively as possible. The plus side of all of that is whatever dollars are available go to the projects that are ready to use them, and that's why some that are moving not quite as fast lose some of the money in any given year, and some others that are moving a little bit faster get the money. So what this is doing is putting a level of sophistication on top of our overall program that says we are using the money much more effectively than we have in the past, and that's why you see all of these changes going on. Had we been in our old way of managing, none of this would have been visible, and none of this would have been done. So all of this is really a positive change that is improving everything compared to where we've been in the entire history of the authority. It is not that somebody's doing something wrong right now. They're doing everything right. Now, there is a downside to this, and the downside to this is for those of us that have to pay for this, that means the local jurisdictions, the more effectively Metro uses its money, the more we have to pay. In the old days, you know, if they didn't do it very effectively, we didn't have to give them the money. So what is going on here is, and this, of course, ties to the fact that in our current capital funding agreement, we are at the point of saying, hey, if you aren't going to spend it, we aren't going to give it to you. It is now putting more of a burden on us to actually come up with the money we promised. So from a Metro point of view, this is the best way we can possibly do things, and this kind of presentation and this discussion that we're having shows how sophisticated we're getting and how good we're getting at making sure that we deliver programs and we deliver programs in the most effective way possible. Now, in there, I heard very quickly a comment that raised my concern, because one of the things I thought I heard was we've changed our projections for federal funding.
Yes, we actually lowered them for FY12. And given what we think is going to be, we're conservative in that approach. It's not that we're promoting a lower federal funding at all. It's just that we are anticipating that we would have a lower federal funding in FY12. So we have a flat growth right now for that formula funds. Yes.
And only for 12, or is it 12 and beyond?
12 and 13. Carol, you want me
yeah,
to
12. I'm sorry, yes.
12 and 13 are flat, and then it starts to be able to increase in the out years.
What are the assumptions beyond 13?
I think they're 4%.
2.5%.
2.5%, and it grows up.
And it used to be about 4, right?
Mm-hmm.
4 and 5.
So what we're talking about right now is that the authority is projecting that based upon what we're hearing, that we're going to have something like a continuing resolution this year, and therefore we won't get any more money.
Right, and if it changes, we would actually, we have many projects ready to be, right and ready to go, so we have lists of those projects in our CNI.
But our projection now is that the federal government will not be helping us any more this year than they did last year, and so we're actually reducing the amount that we think we're going to spend compared to where we were when we approved the budget. Is that right? Okay. And the difference is it deferred projects or is it additional borrowing some other time?
No, not additional borrowing. We're keeping within the confines of the capital funding agreement that our jurisdictional partners signed, the six-year agreement. So we're just deferring projects.
So the federal funding and or our projections of federal funding and what we're hearing now from the federal government and the local match are no longer assumed to be coming on that differential, is that right? And therefore, those projects will not occur at this time.
We are still actually asking for the local match in system performance funds, so that we don't have that much of a negative impact in our budget.
Okay, so you were still saying
that
the local match will arrive, but the federal funds will not, so there's going to be an even larger local share compared to federal than we are, because we've already been overmatching. And you're saying you're going to ask for even a greater overmatch, but the federal government is not going to be doing its share. I just wanted to note that for our federal representative.
Well, thank you. Thank you for bringing that to my attention. And I would say, if we are able to maintain our level of federal funding flat, that will be a major victory, in all honesty. We'll discuss this further when the budget is being adopted, but we're in very troubled times with respect to the availability of funding. I just want to make one other point. I think Mr. Benjamin is correct in terms of one of the reasons for this level of sophistication. The other is we are managing a capital program that is probably twice as big as it has been in the past, and clearly and twice as complex. And having this ability to manage it will be critical, however it's getting paid for.
And can I just add to the pressure a little bit? Yes, it is. I'm sorry, I was just speaking too softly. We have basically taken out of this budget in the last adjustments any remaining enhancements to the Washington Metro system. So as we look to no increases in federal funding or more modest increases in federal funding, we are now into impacting state-of-the-art repair projects. And as we've said time and again, and it was established even, before I got here, the capital needs assessment is much greater than had been projected even in our capital funding agreement, and certainly over what we see coming over the next 5-6 years. So this is something to be concerned about with regard to our state of the repair as the amount of funding declines or projected funding declines.
I would only change Mr. Benjamin's comment in one manner, and that you said higher pressure from the jurisdictions, but hopefully a lot more encouragement because actually we're delivering, and that's really another important key there. Mr. McKay.
I was going to say something along the same lines to complete Mr. Benjamin's train of thought. This change is good for Metro. Speaking for my jurisdiction, it's good for our jurisdiction. I mean, we appropriate the money. We want it spent. We assume a state of good repair, and the only thing worse is asking our customers to pay more in fares and then to find out the jurisdictional capital support isn't being spent to ensure a state of good repair and good service. So I think it's a good thing for my jurisdiction as well. We appropriate that money for a reason. We want it spent. We want a state of good repair, and I think that's a major step forward, especially in light of what Mr. Sarles just said about, funding sources from other places. Makes it even more imperative to make sure that what we do have, especially if it's going down, actually gets all spent. And speaking for Fairfax, at least, that's why we put that money there. That's why we want it spent. That's why we want a state of good repair. So I certainly don't want it to be misconstrued that this is just a good change for WMATA. We see it as a good change for our riders as well.
I did want to comment that first of all, I don't think any of us doesn't want the money spent. We all want the money spent. We want it spent as efficiently and as effectively as possible. I would like to just reflect on the comment that was made by the general manager just this moment, which is, with the reduction in federal funding, all we will be able to do, if I heard you correctly, Mr. Sarles, is fix what's broken and bring it up to higher standards of where it used to be. But doing any enhancements, doing anything to deal with additional ridership, additional ability to make the ride better for our passengers, providing additional service, that we aren't going to be able to do because we won't be able to have the capital money to buy the equipment and make the investments to deal with an expanding ridership. Okay.
Donatelli and staff, and we will move to the next item, which is the FY 2012 proposed budget, and this sets us in the stage of moving forward on the process as well as the budget itself for 2012. Ms. Kissel.
Thank you. I'm going to actually have handed out the proposed FY12 budget books that we have for each one of the board members. It's also available after today's meeting. It will be available online to be accessed on our Metro website in full detail. I'm not going to take you page by page through this budget book that you have, but I will give you a sense of what's in the budget book. First of all, this is the proposed general manager's budget for FY12. And in the beginning of the budget book, you will see there is the general manager's message, which we will talk about later in the presentation. The budget development assumptions are in the budget book. There's a profile of Metro, what services we provide in the region, a comprehensive list of oversight bodies that guide us in some of the directions. The beginnings of a strategic plan and framework is in the budget book, focuses on the goals and objectives of the organization, the vital statistics that we've implemented this year on our performance, the organization itself, the functions that we all in departments in detail, their mission and goal statements tied to our five goals and objectives on safety and all of our other goals. We also have detailed profiles of those departments, headcount, average salary, year-to-year comparison, sources of funds, a full description of the capital program that you'll see in there, as well as the annual work plan of our capital program for FY12. So I won't go through it section by section, but in summary, it is a very comprehensive document. And I will take you now through some of the highlights of that. This is a proposed budget. We look at it as a working document based upon the direction that the jurisdictions and the board gives us. We will be modifying this between now and when the approved budget is done in June. So that being said, the first page, I don't need to tell the board that Metro is obviously a critical to the residents and the businesses of the region, and that is a known fact. This chart just clearly represents, the average weekday trips that we see, 1.2 million trips, average weekday a day, and that's really projected out to be over 343 million trips in FY 2011 this year. Metro Rail, Metro Bus, on the left side of the pie chart you see how that's by residence, where those trips are taken. As you can see, it's mostly a regional, true regional system. On the right side, you see most of the trips are going to work and home. And this is based on surveys. This data source here is a 2007 survey. We actually do passenger surveys every couple of years. We're probably projected to do one this year to update that information. But it's a critical, we play a critical role in the region. Next slide. What are some of the benefits of Metro? The obvious benefits here, 17% of the region's commuting trips. We are removing vehicles from the roadways, people using our system. We alleviate traffic congestion and save hours of travel time. We do support the federal government in terms of commuting. 50% of our stations are located actually at federal facilities, and we estimate about 40% of our riders are our federal employees. We generate almost $40 billion of economic development around the stations in D.C. alone. That does not include some other development that's happening outside of the region. And we sustain the region's economic growth. As you can see, our planning department has estimated by 2040 that there will be about a 40% job growth between now and then. So our initiatives going forward, this year and going forward to the next year, we are currently managing, as I said earlier, the largest investment in our capital program since Metro was in the construction phases. And you saw or heard a little bit about that from Dave Donatelli and Dave Kubicek, who's managing a bulk, actually the majority of that capital investment. And under the leadership of the general manager, we have begun to see some of the benefits of that focus in safety investments, the state of grid repair, the replacement of the 1000 series, which we are in progress of doing, and we are promoting, in the efforts that he has in promoting the use of public transit and actually rehabbing the bus facilities and improving safety and reliability overall in the system. What do we look like? In analyzing the cost structure of Metro, just over 90% of the total operating cost directly supports our core services, bus, rail, and Metro access. And about 9% of cost in our budget funds the supporting functions that ensure that that is operating efficiently. And as you can see, we listed some of those supporting functions there. To provide some context for you, other transit agencies, we've taken a look at their structure, and they fall anywhere between 8 to 12 or 8 to 13% in terms of supporting infrastructure to their core services. We have actual, the general manager in his role as the leader at New Jersey Transit saw his administration functions go from 13% to I think, 8%. So he is leading us in that effort. We've actually seen some efficiencies in 2009. We were at a 10% level, and we're continuing to look at that as well. So I think we're on the low end of that, which is good. And you've heard the general manager say in the past that we have already been cut to the bone in regard to that. So we can talk about that a little bit later. The operating cost structure. Over the last 3 years, as I mentioned, we've taken a look at efficiencies that we've needed to put in place from our operating cost structure and to some extent have been forced to put in place because of some of the economic conditions that have that we are experiencing as well as the states, other public entities, and municipalities, and other companies for that matter. So we've actually, over the last 3 years, taken a $165 million drop in our operating cost structure, and I'll talk a little bit about that later, but the highlights here of we've done some positive things about implementing efficiencies in our organization, which we needed to do. So some things about consolidation where we needed to in organizations where we've had redundancies, we've looked at that. We've actually implemented where we can use implementation of technology better. We've done that. And we've dropped our cost in that regard. But we've also done other things in terms of our post-retirement benefits. Some of you know we actually use a pay-as-you-go system. It's fully funded on a pay-as-you-go system. We've actually done some other things where we've suspended our leadership programs, which are negative to recruitment and talent, but it's the economy that we're living in currently. We've looked at also reducing some of our hours in our Metro Sales Center so that we can actually try to be more efficient there. So we've looked at a couple of different things in order to get that structure. To give you a better view of that on the next chart, I took the last 2 years to give you some comparison, and some of you, or all of you, remember this. You know, back in 2010, we had a very large gap. We worked very hard to solve it. We had, at the end of the year, a 10-cent fare increase, if you recall, and that was primarily a direct result of the heavy snows that we had and the drastic closures that we experienced in December and then in February, subsequent days in a row. And we lost a lot of revenue for that. We also had challenges. We looked at preventative maintenance. We increased, borrowed from capital, if you will, to close some gaps we had there. We definitely had increase in jurisdictional subsidies in 2010, and we had the organizational efficiencies that I spoke about. The $81 million that you see here is a result of taking over 300 positions out of our organization in the operating side. Some of them were filled positions, and some of them were not filled positions. We have never reestablished them, so that's an ongoing cost structural change that we're carrying forward. We've also drawn down on reserves in order to close gaps. We did have a positive in 2009, $13 million positive, which was adjusted to $6 million, so we carried that over, and then we had some other changes. This year's budget, in FY11 that we're dealing with now. It was approved last June. $108 million was due to fare increases. The large gap that you see, the 189, most of that was closed with fare increases to the rider. We did look at $30 million of preventative maintenance, increased more from the prior year. So, again, taking money from capital and moving it into operating to help us close those gaps. Those are one time, and they have risks associated with them, as you all know. We did also have additional jurisdictional commitment in this year, an additional $25 million. And again, we looked at continued organizational efficiencies. Last year, we did reduce positions. We riffed people, and we did more consolidation in some of our organizational structures. And we also, I don't want to forget about Metro Access. We actually looked at some of the reductions and changes in Metro Access that we're implementing this year in order to stem some of the growth that we have in that particular service. So the projected gap that I communicated early in November, we just took a look at our cost structure because we did not want to talk about revenue yet. We wanted to just look at cost. And what we had presented to you in November was we would be in about an $89 million deficit. The general manager had tasked the executive leadership team at Metro to come up with another $25 million in additional reductions. We have worked hard to do that, and I'll talk about that in a little while. We also now took a look finally at revenue, and I'm proposing that we actually have a decrease in revenue for this FY12 budget based upon some of the analysis that we've done, which takes it down to a $20 million level versus where we are currently. So that's a change. It's due to the economic climate that we're still seeing the vestiges of. It may pick up, but right now we're looking at that as a conservative decline in growth. Budget to budget, yes, thank you. I'm sorry. It's budget to budget, slower growth. If you looked at our ridership, and I want to be clear about this, and it's very clear in the budget book, we are actually holding our own relative to ridership, you know, year to year to year. It's just that when you look at ridership compared to budget, we are not beating those budget projections. It says that we may have been aggressive in our budget projections, and that may be, and that's actually what we're seeing. But year to year, we're actually holding our own on ridership in terms of actuals. Just the growth is not happening as much as we would like it to be. So let's go to this. We tried to simplify this, and I think this chart does it, and I know it's busy, but I'd like to just take a moment to really take you through it step by step. The adopted budget, we start there. That's the budget we're living with today. It's $831 million in revenue and $1.4 billion in expenses. The subsidy that we get from the jurisdictions is $572 million. So the fare box and the subsidy close our operating budget. We have a zero deficit. We look at FY12. I'm going to jump down to the right of the chart on the red. That's the $89 million that I had spoke about in November. How did we get there? We had we mostly focused on cost, and I'd like to focus on the expense side. Most of our increase in cost, as I indicated in November, is due to labor. Our biggest asset, as you all know, our biggest cost expense, if you will, in Metro is labor. It's 80% of our costs. So we actually have labor and fringe benefits that are growing. That includes labor, salary, wages, overtime, fringes, pension. And that's an addition that we have to include. We actually have Metro Access growth, and that's about a 10% growth that we're seeing in Metro Access. We also assumed other cost growth. We bundled that together. You can see the detail in the budget book, but really what it is growth in, as we invest in technology, we have hardware and maintenance service contracts that we have to comply with. To maintain some of our hardware and software is proprietary, given our train control systems and other technology that actually runs our core services. So that's a growth in cost there. We had preventative maintenance. We assumed instead of having a $60 million in preventative maintenance, we're bringing it back down to the 2009 levels, which is $30 million. So we're moving the capital that we had borrowed back to the operating budget and going to a $30 million, assuming a $30 million level on that. We have the $25 million cost structural changes that the general manager has requested that the functions come up with, and I'll talk about that later. And we have a deficit of last year, which was $16 million, which the board had to directed us to assume in this going forward budget for FY12. The other side of the equation, when I didn't really talk about revenue in November, but there's a couple things we did know. We did know that we were going to do revenue sharing with the regions. And that's as a result of some of the work we did on the regional passes, bus passes that we have now on our Smart Trip. So it's a real regional system that people can go from Ride-On to Metro and DART to Metro. But now we're sharing that revenue with the jurisdictions. That's a reduction to revenue to Metro. And we just had some other smaller technical adjustments. So the proposed general manager's budget for FY12, the bottom half of that chart, we've included the $20 million slower growth in ridership, and we've had a couple of changes that we've made on the cost side. Some technical changes on the carryover, very small, $200,000. The first one I want to talk about is the overtime. We came to the board a month ago and talked about the vacancy problem that we had in recruiting bus drivers and training classes, which, as many of you know, we use the bus recruitment to recruit for our rail operators. And given some of the structure changes that we had and the hiring freezes that we implemented in 2009 and 10, we were deficient in actually continuing to provide a pipeline of recruitment for that, for those bus driver operators. So what's happening now is we actually are feeling the pain in that, and we're probably 12 months behind in getting to a reasonable vacancy rate for bus drivers and then rail operators, and this affects station managers as well. We have a very good plan in place to actually do a recruitment, and we can talk about that. I think Gary Baldwin may talk about that at next month's meeting or in March. But what we are finally realizing is we will have overtime, scheduled overtime, that we will have to deal with in FY12. Rather than dismiss it, we thought we would manage it. And we would put a number to it, and we would manage the overtime, and that's what that $7 million is. The Metro Access is a number that is additional growth to the 10% growth that we had originally talked about. But this is a number that I know Christian Kent, who is leading Metro Access business model, is working with. So this is additional growth, but it's something that may be able to come down. So right now it's a conservative number, but we may be able to change that as we go forward.
Ms. Kissel.
Yes.
Mr. Janelle.
Yeah, let's talk about that overtime a little more, please. In the upper part of your chart, you had labor and fringe, which you verbally said included overtime.
Yes.
I'd be kind of curious to know what that number was for overtime in that part. Mm-hmm. And then you say in the changes from the November forecast, we're now up 7.3 in addition.
Yes, that's
overtime.
Correct. That's correct.
And I presume that's for the projection for the year, correct?
That's the projection for the year.
But how much of the first column or the upper column there on labor and fringe was overtime itself? And I don't.
It's only $1.5 million in the 43.7 number. There's $1.5 million associated.
And is this is primarily attributed to the bus operator?
Well, if you recall, it's not. Well, our collective bargaining agreements require that we recruit
rail
operators through bus operators. So it starts at the bus operators, and as a result of not having training classes on a regular basis, we probably need to have about 30. We need to train 30 to 40 bus drivers with CDL license a month. in order to sort of get them in the pipeline.
A key part of that would be attrition rates.
That's correct.
I mean, how many are we losing? I mean, what percentage of our bus operators are we losing each year or...
We've assumed attrition rates in this number. I don't have them right now. And they, are they in the budget book? No, but we can provide the attrition rate assumption.
Okay. Thank you.
What we added is also below that the addition of special police officers. The board had approved this expenditure in this year's budget. And we're just moving it forward into FY12. So the next item, which you see, which is a reduction to our cost structure, actually, is the other structural cost changes. And I'll talk about them in more detail in the next page. But primarily, those are some of the cost changes that we've looked at that are operating expenses that should be capital. And primarily, there are overhaul shops that we have identified, bus overhaul and rail overhaul shops, where labor and parts are actually being funded currently with capital dollars. And we've done this, operating dollars, excuse me. And over the last year or two, we've actually taken a look very closely at these, at this cost structure. And year to year, we bring forward to the board a certain area of this. This is actually the result of a more comprehensive review that we've done, and I'll show you that on the next page. So, yes.
Just follow up. You mentioned you're going to give me some attrition numbers, but
yes.
How much of the overtime is related to police overtime? And if you don't know it, you can give it to me later.
I don't know it off the top of my head. But
all right, okay. I'd like to get that information.
Okay.
Mr. Benjamin.
First of all, again, another one of those context comments. This presentation of the budget for all of the newer board members is not the budget discussion that we're going to have. We are going to have many, many sessions now going through the spring, taking some of these numbers apart and making sure we understand what they are and why they are and what the implications are. So we don't want to walk away from this saying, oh, well, the budget's now done. Nor do we have to ask all our questions now.
This is the beginning. General manager's budget.
This is the general manager's first presentation of his issues. And I did want to highlight at least at this stage a couple of the areas that I hope we will be looking at substantially more as we go forward in order to just give staff a basis for looking at some of the areas, some that Mr. Giancola talked about. There's $43.7 million in labor and fringe benefit increases there. That's increases. Those, I understand, do not include cost of living increases for any of the non-represented employees, correct?
The only amount we've actually included in that item actually are equity adjustments that
this
we've made.
Pay compression?
Yeah, that's right. So what's happened is we have equity adjustments in our that we have to correct due to some salary compression issues. So we have baked in a small amount in that number.
But no overall cost of living increases?
No overall cost of living increases.
But there are cost of living increases assumed based upon the union contract with Local 689 that has yet to be settled. Correct.
That's correct, and we'll talk about that in one of my last pages, yes.
Okay, yeah, I just wanted to note the fact that that's going to be an issue since that is currently in court, and we're going to have to see how the court case works. Metro Access, we're looking now at somewhere in the range of $13 million. It's been pretty much in that range every year that we've had those kinds of increases, but one of the things that I hope we will look at very carefully is what is causing the cost growth, especially if you take a look at your financial report this month, which shows that the ridership growth that we've been having year after year after year doesn't seem to have been occurring, which would perhaps say that some of the things we've been doing in order to focus on potential cost savings in Metro Access are occurring. And one of the things I think we want to look at is what happens in the future in those areas. Preventive maintenance, clearly there's a $30 million. We jumped from $30 million traditionally that we've had in for a number of years in preventive maintenance up to $60 million. And that was in order to balance the budget. And just so that everybody understands, we aren't changing the amount of preventive maintenance we do, all we're changing is where we're funding it, whether we're funding it out of our capital budget or out of our operating budget. And many of us are very concerned, and we're very concerned when we did it previously, that when you take $30 million out of your capital budget, or essentially charge money to your capital budget, that balances your operating budget, you've just taken $30 million out of your capital budget for that year and probably for future years. So this is an attempt to get it back down, but it's balanced by that line down on the bottom that says other structural cost changes, many of which are increases or switches, and legitimate and appropriate switches of costs that have been carried in the operating budget that should have been carried in the capital budget. But once we put that in there, that says that some part of that 49 is going to carry over for many years as a reduction in the capital. And we were just talking about how constrained our capital budget was already. So those are issues that I think we're going to need to focus on as we go through this, above and beyond the ones that are presented a little bit farther here. Really major issues where we've got to look at it and say, what do we on a policy level want to do in this organization between these two budgets, and what can we afford to do given the support that's available both federally and locally?
Okay. And and since Mr. Benjamin mentioned it, I just want to say that the structural changes that he's speaking about, as well as the preventative maintenance level, we've assumed that in our capital budget going forward. So we've tied those in already, making sure that they are linked. So just to give you, to finish this busy chart, we get to the proposed budget, which is this $1.4 billion on the expense side. And the reason I do the last two numbers is because I want to make sure that the 1.483, that's my control number that ties to the budget book. And we do two things here. One is, when I look at the carryover of the deficit of the $16.4 million that we had in 10, it's really not a current year FY12 expenditure. So even though, and it won't affect subsidy, but from the board direction, I bill that to the jurisdictions actually this month, and the jurisdictions have decided to make that payment as part of the FY12 budget. So it's really not an FY12 expenditure, so I back it out. And then the second thing I do is I add back the debt, which is the debt service payments that are agreed to by the jurisdictions in Metro Matters prior bond issues that support the capital program, and even pre-Metro Matters. So that's another adjustment that I make in order to, and that is an operating expense, so I have to include that. And that's really why I get to the control number of 1.483. So let's talk about the two cost structure changes that we're making. The one that the general manager challenged the executive leadership team to come up with, which was the $25 million, and then the structural changes that I talked about, which was the 49.2. We'll talk about the 49.2 first. Those are a result of a comprehensive review that Dave Kubitschek, Jack Rico, and myself have made, looking at our overhaul shops. You know, Greenbelt, Brentwood are overhaul shops for rail, and then the Bladensburg and Carmen Turner are the overhaul shops for bus. And in the past, we have used operating dollars to fund that. Now, anytime we designate under GAAP, under FTA guidelines, an overhaul shop, which is extending the life of an asset, you are able to capitalize labor and parts. And so we've set up our systems in place to capture that. We've designated those facilities as just that. And that's basically, that's $30 million of some of the changes that are going over to capital. We also are doing a health verification audit. This is something that Metro has never done. And really what it's looking at is to try to be more efficient in our health care costs and what we pay. So many companies have done this where they have done an they initiate a dependent review, basically. And we're rolling that out at the end of this month. The general manager has approved, and letters will be going out to our employees. Our union environment, some of the board trustees under the union agreements are also participating in that. So that'll be good. I have a conservative number based upon our auditors who indicate that there'll be a savings of about a little over $3 million. It may be more, but that's the number that we have there now. And it's just really, it's verifying dependability. You know, if you have a dependent and they're being covered and you're employed by Metro, you know. MTB, the Chief Taborn, is doing a lot to figure out how to redeploy his resource effectively. Where he can put uniformed officers, take uniformed officers into a civilian position, he is doing that. That does not mean that there will be no uniformed officers are being replaced from out in our system. He's very cognizant of that. He's just redeploying his efforts a lot more efficiently. Fuel and propulsion savings, we are continuing to see benefits from this. Even this year, as many of you know, we have hedge programs in place for our diesel fuel, and we have hedge programs in place, swap agreements for our propulsion. We've seen benefits this year. Actually, a lot of the fuel energy savings that we're seeing this year is offsetting the decline that we're seeing in some of our revenue. So again, we expect to have that savings next year as well. We're using technology to be smarter about parking facilities. Our parking decks are very old. They're manned. It's a manual process. We are implementing debit credit card capability to exit our parking structures. So if you don't have a Smart Trip card, as you all know, right now you have to get out, go back to the station, get a Smart Trip card. In order to make the experience more pleasant to our customers and to gain some efficiencies, we're looking to use technology. At the end of this year, in June, we'll have every parking structure will have at least one lane that will have a debit credit card ability to exit. At the end of this year, we will have all of the lanes with debit credit card, and we will have the ability to do remote lifting of the gate at a remote central facility. Those types of investments that we're making will have operating savings in about $1.6 million. We also have many other reduction in support savings. I won't go through them all, but you can see them in the budget book. Every functional department, including my own, has come up with restructuring and cost savings that we can sustain into next year and do not impact the core services that we provide to rail, bus, and access. We also have some other technology changes in bus and rail. This is due to our Trapeze system, which is our scheduling system that manages our bus and rail scheduling. Jack Requa is a sponsor of a major program that's integrating the Trapeze system, and because of the technology investments he's making on that, he's committing to some savings on operations sides on the house for that. We have an adjustment on fringe benefit. This is really primarily due. We had higher projected rates in the beginning of our budget process, and we've just brought them down a bit. The grant-funded positions are actually Chief Taborn has a grant that he's able to fund his canine and anti-terrorism. So instead of using operating dollars, he's able to fund it through grants. And we also have some track system vehicle capital projects that Dave has identified that are true capital projects that should be funded and their staff that should be funded with capital. And that assessment has been with the help of some of the stuff that PB has done for us, the work that he's done for PB, or for PB has done for us. Overhead allocation. This is actually a good news because we do an overhead allocation model. It's a methodology that doesn't change much. But basically what it does is, for administrative support functions that support bus and rail, 15% of their cost structure, if you will, gets funded to the capital programs. As our capital program blossoms into a billion-dollar program, more of that 15% will be going over to capital. So this is really just it's not a methodology change. It's just a cost allocation methodology, which actually moves some of the support over to capital, and we get some savings in the operating. Casualty, yeah. I'm sorry. Yes. Okay, casualty and liability. This is not necessarily a savings in our premium insurance. As you know, we carry very high property liability. This actually is a reduction and third-party claims and workers' comp, not necessarily new ones, but as you know, we carry older claims that we pay. So as older claims get dropped off of the schedule, we actually see a reduction in the payout of that. So that's a good news story, and we get this information from our actuarials, and so we bake that in as well. And then we have planning functions, again, that are directly supporting the capital program for Dave and Jack and Christian, and so we've been able to see some reductions there.
Taking that one and several others, we clearly have identified correctly in accordance with GAAP a number of activities that can be funded from the capital program. This is different from preventive maintenance, which is something that technically is not capital but is deemed to be capital by an obscure provision of federal law. However, these are real dollars, and as you put together the capital program for 2012 and going forward, this will absorb some degree of the margin, and I hope we'll be able to kind of see as we look at the amount, look at how the capital program has changed, what the effect of these decisions has been and will be, because these will be permanent. This won't ever go away.
Well, with regard to your first question, you're absolutely right. These are all approved GAAP, reasons and determinations, and to move, if you're funding with operating, and then it should be capital. That's under GAAP. In terms of your second question, all of these changes that we've done here are already included and assumed in the capital FY12 program as we've looked at our funding levels there.
But to the extent they weren't there before,
yeah,
they have to have been a displacement of something else.
That's correct. And we
and
can,
were we to allow that to happen and go back in for some more capital maintenance, we will really be cannibalizing the capital program.
Yeah, that's correct. So a fully funded program to fund what I've just briefly described to you in terms of our operating cost structure would continue the Friday and Saturday late night service. We put a value to that just so you can see it, the weekend service, the non-regional service, the current head waste, station mezzanine hours, late night, Yellow Line extension to Fort Totten. We've actually continued the current access levels. As you know, if we don't have that infrastructure, we're not required to provide that service, but that would be the value that we've associated with that service above, and also the support functions that would go along with that. So we just tried to give you a picture of what a fully funded service would be.
Madam Chair, I just wanted, can you back up for a second? The first one, when you talk about Friday and Saturday late night, that's rail and bus, right? Not
yes.
just bus,
because yes.
it says bus service including. So if we dropped late night Friday and Saturday service, we would do that savings as well as the benefits to our maintenance program. But it's a $3 million savings for both. Yes?
Can you give me a moment to clarify that? I don't want to give you a wrong answer, but I believe it is rail and bus.
It isn't important to do at this moment.
Oh, okay.
It's important to do as we go through the budget
yes.
in detail.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. The next chart, please. So as you saw on the crosswalk chart, the general manager is proposing in his budget an increase in subsidy of $72 million. $72.5 million. There are other options that we're providing here. We could look at monetization, some of our ground leases. We have about 14 ground leases throughout our structure. We could look at that and monetize that. We've put a value to that. Of course, that would take $4 million annually a year out of our revenue structure, so we'd have to fill that gap on that. We could do station naming rights. Barbara Richardson is our AGM for marketing communications. This is something that she's done before. We could explore this. We don't know if that's a low value or not. We've just put a value to it. And we can look at, of course, our preventive maintenance levels, keeping them at the existing year, current levels that we have now at $60 million. So we'd add another $30 million. Or we can look at reserve for wages. This is what Mr. Benjamin had talked about. we have currently reserved for wages. And if we modify, we could modify potentially our reserve that we currently have on our books for the last 3 years, and it would, could be a net reduction of $35 million. So those are some other options that we have to fund.
You know, just to back on page 31, you talked about levels of service on Saturday and Sunday service and Friday, late Saturday.
Yes.
And also the Yellow Line extension to Fort Dunn. Associated with that, when you come back to us, I would certainly like to see some numbers. In other words, how many people are actually using the late night service from what we cut back to? Mm-hmm. In other words, the Delta. And also on the Yellow Line extension, clearly what kind of usage do we get by extending the Yellow Line from, I believe, from Mount Vernon to Fort Totten, correct? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
Because I take that line, you know, not at night, but, you know.
You take that line, is that right?
Sometimes.
Related to that. Did you make any assumptions, is this Yellow Line issue sparked an idea, did you make any assumptions about the long overdue plan to split the yellow and blue lines, the, you know, what we discussed in operations some time ago, and we were moving forward with looking at how we tag that. Did you make any assumptions about that implementation in this next fiscal year?
No, we didn't. This is just a it's just a order of magnitude that this is what the value of that would be, but no, we didn't make any assumptions.
Okay.
First of all, I'd like to compliment staff. I think you did an excellent presentation as an overview. It very clearly lays out where we've been, what you've assumed, where we're going. You have clearly indicated the drivers, which is very, very important. And you've done it all in a manner that makes it very understandable. You've also put before us the difficult job that we as a board will need to do, in addition to looking at the numbers a little bit more, and that is, you put in front of us a series of unpalatable choices. $72 million of increase in subsidy, which would be difficult to do but conceivable in a cost-constrained climate in each one of the jurisdictions, or a bunch of these options, which aren't very exciting either. So I think you've done well. You've laid out our task very well, and now it's our job to try and follow through on that.
Yes, I'd like to also echo my thanks to the staff for this excellent presentation. I'm curious about, we've made some major fare changes over the last year, including a peak of the peak fare. And I'm just curious about, are we preparing an evaluation of that, and does this budget have any recommendations for any fare changes? Based on our experiences over the last couple of months, because a lot of this was new, a lot of it was untried, and I'd like to get a better sense in terms of whether they're working or not and whether they're producing the revenue that we had anticipated, or do we need to make any changes to that fare structure in order to get better revenue, but also more customer convenience. So was that something we're planning to do as part of this discussion?
It definitely is, and I mentioned before, we're doing it in February, the short answer, and you know, we've had some, because we've implemented the major fare upgrade on our collection systems, we had a lot of fits and starts on that, so we didn't get a clear, we didn't get clear business analytics for the first quarter, and so it could skew sort of any determination that we make, but I think we're scheduled for next month. And we'll have a big discussion, I'm sure, on revenue, the impact of the fare increases, and more detail on that. Yes.
Yes, thank you. I think we do have a really good product here to begin the deliberations, and I'm sure over the next several months things will change, assumptions will change, we'll continue to track those, we'll continue to know more. But as Mr. Benjamin said, it's a difficult menu. But I think it warrants getting a clear picture that if we had to act today, maintain current levels of service, maintain fares, achieve the level of efficiencies that the general manager thinks can be achieved, and they're substantial, and maintain safety on the system, this is the result.
It's a zero-sum game. And as we go forward, one or the other of those factors really have to be dealt with. There's no magic here. And I think it's a good starting point, and I hope as we go through the debate, we'll have good information about what all those options are, because we're going to have to look at a lot of options.
Thank you very much, Ms. Kissel, and staff are, I think, a very good presentation. And I think, as was noted, this is the general manager's budget, and so it's our diligence that we have in determining, given the foundation, what and where are we going to go with it and how. I wanted to turn to the calendar that is proposed here. I would like to ask, because I think there are some conditions that we might not be required to have public hearing, but I think from a consensus of this board, we might determine that we do want to have public hearings. So maybe we don't, not necessary, but they are necessary. I also want to share with you the fact that I met with the Accessibility Committee last Wednesday. My timetable is off. But at the meeting, it was quite clear that they have been working very diligently looking at what does the budget look like and how it affects them. And I think we may want to consider a manner in which we can build in, beyond the public hearing, of hearing from those two customer groups as we continue our discussion here. For example, the Writers Advisory Council as well as the AAC. And so when we look at our calendar, we think about those things. And then the urging, I guess what we're saying is our budget is clear and in detail in our books, and so I think our questions and deliberations can be very much focused with the information we have in order to, I think, accomplish in the time frame that we have here. If we recall last year, this time frame was not at all able to be met, but I think we should be diligent in trying to meet that time frame, because I think it gives the staff the latitude in order to truly implement the budget quickly, rather than what we have experienced in 2010, but in the 2010 year. Okay. Are there any questions on the budget piece? If not, thank you very much. Thank you much. Yes, we do have another item. And Mr. Giancola, you're going to start as soon as we finish, right?
Okay. So I'll just
we will finish quickly, but we don't want to.
We'll just go through the monthly performance report.
But we do want to go to it with clear clarity. Okay.
Great. I'll be quick. I'm Matt Brown, the budget director. If you could turn to page 46 of your packet, that shows the year-to-date and monthly financials for November. And I'll just go through the highlights. In short, overall, we're on budget. Shortfalls that we've seen in revenues are offset by expenditure underruns. As we've reported to the board previously, both bus and rail ridership have been below budget expectations to date. For rail, and I'll wait till the page comes up.
Page 46.
I think it's page 46 in your book.
Yeah, we have a
page. Okay, they have a
page. All right, so I'll continue. For rail, year-to-date ridership remains slightly higher than FY10, but again, below budget expectations. One anomaly that you may have noticed in the current month's ridership is that for the month, rail ridership is up over the previous year, but for all of the time periods, it's down. We had an extra weekday this current year as compared to last year. For bus, year-to-date ridership is below FY10 levels. However, in the current month, in November, ridership was slightly above November last year. We don't know yet if that's a trend, but it's a positive sign. We'll obviously continue to monitor both bus and rail ridership, as this may impact our budget discussions as we go forward. The budget estimates, the ridership and revenue estimates, were based on year-to-date ridership for the current fiscal year. And so there's an opportunity to adjust the ridership in the proposed budget as we continue to monitor year-to-date results. We're on budget because expenditures overall, like revenue, are below budget. A couple of them Carol has already talked about. Fuel and propulsion savings have been significant to date. Year-to-date, we're over budget on personnel costs by $5 million. That's mainly due to overtime, bus overtime that we've talked about previously. Materials and supplies are also over budget. Again, it's bus and rail transportation costs and windshields and parts for unanticipated work. The expenditure categories that are favorable are fringe benefits, which is mainly the pension costs, services, and again, power and utilities, which together are about $10.5 million. You've heard a lot this morning about the capital program, so I'll be even briefer when I talk about it. Year to date, for November, we've obligated about 65% of our capital program, and we've spent about 20%. We anticipate that those numbers will improve, as Ms. Kissel mentioned, through the second quarter results, which we will report to the board next month. That's all I have. Thanks.
Yeah, question, looking at the parking revenues and utilization figures, as you can see on the blue screen up there, as well as, they're below that. You know, our rail ridership's basically been sustained throughout the year, but we are seeing lower levels of revenue and utilization. What do we know about what's going on, and is there a problem we need to correct?
There's two things happening. We have some of the parking utilization is off in maybe six or eight of the stations that we have, and we're taking a look at that. The issues are two. The systems that we deployed, the NextFair 5 upgrade, we had poor communication infrastructure at our parking decks, and as a result, we had more failures. Rather than keeping people in the parking lot without exiting, we've just opened the gates when those happen and have deployed people to fix the infrastructure. So, and that takes a bit more time. And so that's one issue which we've actually made a lot of strides on. The second issue is another issue in terms of just it's the impact of the growth that we expected in parking, which was the growth that we had in our ridership. So when that budget doesn't materialize, we see the impact in the parking. We'll have a better analysis. I think believe Nat Boddinghammer and the parking folks that we have that are implementing the technology changes are looking at this very clearly. So we can have a broader analysis for you at the next month's monthly. We'll include it in the monthly report if you like.
On that, of course, thank goodness we didn't increase the fares last time on parking, because, of course, that number would be even worse. But my question is, a number of these parking garages also had major rehabilitation work done where there were a number of spaces that could not be utilized, period. And I hope that when we do the analysis, we take into consideration that, because there were hundreds of spaces at some of these garages that could not be used during this period of time. So I just want to make sure that's a part of the analysis.
And that's continuing, actually. I just wanted to go back to discussion we have basically every month. And I think, Ms. Brown, you mentioned these. Metro Rail ridership year-to-date is right where it was last year. I mean, you know, minor differences. Average weekday is down a little bit. You pointed out what the difference is there. But what that's telling us is that probably our largest fare increase ever is having little or no effect on ridership. We're not losing a lot of ridership. We're also not gaining any, which is what we had hoped. But the economy doesn't really cause us to see much gain. If you look at the chart that you put up there, a very, very, very large part of our ridership comes for people going to and from work, and if they don't have jobs, they don't ride. The hopeful sign on bus has been running low and seems to be recovering, a very positive sign. And I think a very positive sign is every year we've seen 10 to 15% increases in Metro Access ridership, which we've argued is, and I talked about this a little bit before, in this case we're seeing only a 2% increase, which says maybe we've finally gotten to the point where this is stabilizing and isn't a sharp increase. It raises some questions about what we do in our future budget. But when I look at, and this I've said in previous months too, when I look at the cost, which was budgeted to be a 10 to 15% increase, what I see is that the cost is in excess of budget. So we still have this problem that we seem to be running extraordinarily high costs for ridership levels that are well below what we expected. And you and I have talked about the fact that the average ride is costing more, but we need to understand that an awful lot better.
I think Mr. Kent is actually coming to the committee next month to describe the impacts of what's happening. And I think there are a lot of good things that are happening in terms of the eligibility, which is slowing some of the demand down. But he will describe in detail some of the cost impacts and some of the business model changes that he's looking to have the board consider.
This ends up being one of our largest budget drivers. And it's one that we really have to pay attention to. And we have a good news, bad news coming through right now.
And Madam Chair, on the parking issue, I hope you will take a look at what, to me, might be a correlation. We're seeing less revenue from parking, and we're seeing a diminished average fare on rail, which suggests people are taking shorter trips. And the question is, are we losing people out at the ends of the line at the at the prices we're now charging? We should look at that. The other question I had was the extraordinary reduction in Metro Access revenues. This, I'm sure that can't be anything but an anomaly, but 73% drop seems...
Even though the revenue is very small, considering our fare box, it is, I think Christian is going to discuss that when he comes back next month.
We've said a lot about ridership, and I think what is really captured, I think, and needs greater fleshing and comes back with that fare box the fare increase analysis piece across all of the services. But to make draw some conclusions as to the actual impact on the user at the fare rate relative to the ridership numbers that we see, we may adjustments with a limited analysis as to what that impact would be. I think we had some sense of elasticity and those kinds of things. But when you look at who uses the system, at what cost to them, and what happens with their options of alternatives, you see a difference, I think, that we may be reflecting in the numbers and asking for the growth. $14-$15 trip on average or more, even on rail, for rail passengers, may be a point where we can't grow as readily the system. So I think that analysis needs to really hone in on both the paratransit as well as the others on the impacts. Any other questions? Yes.
A comment on that, and of course we have to keep in consideration the ERA stimulus funds and the extension of those benefits for another year. I'm not so sure without that we'd be looking at the ridership numbers that we're looking at. So we're kind of living in this false world of, you know, what is the impact on our riders as we temporarily have this increase in benefits for federal workers. But in the long term, I'm not so sure, you know, what the impacts of that going away are going to be, and we have to be conscious of that.
Any other questions? Any other business to come before? None. With that, we're adjourned. Thank you all.